The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. I'm glad you're here. And this is just fun. John is an old friend. So there's something special when you get to talk to someone you know. And he's got friends and family. His mom is here. I want to see, where's Mama Carl?
Right over here.
There she is.
Great. Thank you.
And this is a wonderful, I guess you could say, bookend, because the last time we spoke for The Betrayal, it was over the internet.
Yeah,
on Zoom,
COVID,
because it was COVID, and now you're back with Tired of Winning. And you know, I wrote some general notes about the book, and I wrote, "Betrayal was an account. Tired of winning feels like a warning."
Yeah,
and it feels as though volatility. I saw you say somewhere that so much volatility to know about. And as you read about the book, you know, it's like he's governing like a ping pong ball, full of away from propriety or traditions. And I wrote this down, it's like governing in free verse, like there are no rules here. And then there's the way that those close to him assess him. And I wanted you to read a note that we marked from somebody after the documents were found in Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, just to set this up, this was in the process of, first of all, I talked to everybody around Trump. And so for all the, like, the vilification of the press and the way that he's personally vilified me and other of my colleagues who covered him, first of all, he was often very accessible himself. But the people around him, in some ways it was the most transparent administration you could possibly have. I mean, all of it in its chaos was there for you to see. So as I was writing this, I reached out to somebody who had spent over a year working at a very senior level in the West Wing with Trump virtually every day. Serious person, and I wanted to get this person's assessment of what was going on. And we had a series of conversations, but then I called him up after all of the sordid details came out about the classified documents that he had pilfered and brought down to Mar-a-Lago. And this person seemed really troubled in a really big way. And he told me that when the news came out and he saw it, he went to his computer and he just started writing a note to himself. This is somebody who has never gone public with his criticism of Trump. He's actually left politics since leaving the White House. So he's not one of the usual suspects. This isn't like, you know, people like John Kelly who have gone out there and have turned on him in a very public way. This is somebody that has left and just left it behind him. And this is what he wrote to himself. And then I said, of course, I asked, hey, could you mind sending that to me? Again, senior official in the Trump West Wing for more than a year. He lacks any shred of human decency, humility, or caring. He is morally bankrupt, breathlessly dishonest, lethally incompetent, and stunningly ignorant of virtually anything related to governing, history, geography, human events, or world affairs. He is a traitor and a malignancy in our nation and represents a clear and present danger to our democracy and to the rule of law. That's somebody who served Donald Trump. And I was like, wow.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
You know, you lay out a lot of things in Betrayal,
yeah,
you know, that are sort of presage where we are right now. He was volatile then. He switched between topics 15 times a day. People kept things from him. Things were nonsensical. It was no clear sense of governing. Is it worse? Is it discernibly worse now compared to as you were finishing up Betrayal?
So worse is a judgment that as a journalist I don't like to make. But the answer is yes, and let me explain why I'm able to answer that as a journalist. Look, I'm a reporter. I've known Donald Trump I first did a story on him in 1994. So I mean, we're coming on 30 years. I did the first network interview with him of the 2016 cycle. It was back in 2013, 2 years before the escalator. I went into covering that. I happened to be in the White House. So bizarre to having been with him as a young reporter in New York. And he was kind of good copy. I mean, he was somebody I could like, there's a whole story in the first book I wrote about how, I first came into contact with him, but he was somebody that I could like call up and he would always get back to you almost immediately. And, he was kind of entertaining. You never really took him too seriously. But then to think he's back, he's at the White House. I'm a White House correspondent. Not only that, I'm the incoming president of the White House Correspondents Association. Well, I took it very seriously, the idea that I'm going to treat him fairly. It doesn't matter whether I agree or disagree with anything he's doing. I'm going to stick to the facts. And I think there were a lot of reporters who got caught into a war with him because he declared war on us. You're the enemy of the people, and you get into this back and forth. It's not my job. Who cares what I think of the president? I'm there to report what's actually going on. But as things continued to get stranger in that White House, that there are certain things you have to just say what it is. I mean, what I like to say is as a reporter, and you're one of the great reporters, we work together, and it's so cool to be here on this stage with you, and we've been together on campaigns, and that it's the core of our being to be fair and balanced, to try to strive for objectivity insofar as we possibly can. But I think that years from now, whether it's 2 years from now or 20 years from now or 50 years from now, we will be judged. The first question they're not going to ask is, were you fair to Donald Trump? They're going to ask, did you say what the truth was? And did you pursue the truth? But I'm sorry for the long answer, but it is... He, I think, is more prone to destroy the norms of American democracy now than he was when he came in. And more importantly than that, so he's changed in a way, and a little angrier and a little more, maybe a lot more bent on things like vengeance and retribution. He says it. This is not, again, I'm not making a value judgment here. I'm describing what he says. But maybe more importantly, there is nobody left around him like this guy who I just quoted, who was there because he wanted, whoever the president is, the president needs to have good people around him. And you had people who felt it was their duty in a Trump White House to try to prevent him from doing damage to himself politically, and to the country. And they would kind of steer him in one direction or the other, or maybe take an order and not quite, we'll put this over here for now. There's a story in one of Woodward's books about Gary Cohn. There's a letter of some kind, an order on the Resolute desk, and Cohn literally grabs it off the desks and put it in his pocket and knows that Trump's going to be off to something else anyway in the next 5 minutes and, try to... But those people are gone. Those people are... A second Trump term... is going to be run by a character that's in this book you'll read a lot about, named Johnny McEntee, who is going to be the guy. One of the people who is going to be ensuring that the people that serve Trump in that West Wing and in the various agencies of the federal government are loyal. Their first and most important qualification is loyalty to Trump. As one of Johnny McEntee's he was the guy that ran presidential personnel as a 30-year-old in the last year of the Trump White House. And one of the other kids younger who brought in said, the funny thing is you can teach policy, but you can't teach loyalty. So it's more important. We just need loyalty, and then we'll worry about the policy.
And we should point out that most people, when they take these jobs, take an oath to be loyal to the Constitution. Yeah. Not to an individual. Yeah. And it was interesting in reading the book that I could see between the two books how it pushed you. If I were to do a subtitle on the first one, it would be Betrayal, Here's What I Saw. And this one would have been Tired of Winning. Guys, this is batshit. It very different. And I knew, given your stance on so many things, what it took to push you into that place. Yes. Where you felt you needed to say it. How much... as I read through this and you tell these stories, I found myself wondering how much is it chaos agent and how much of it is intentional? Let's say the issue of race.
Yep.
You tell the story about him going to CPAC and giving a very dark speech that ends with, "And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution. I am your retribution." The next day you talk to Steve Bannon, and he starts calling it the come retribution speech, and you realize that's not an accident.
Yeah,
those were code words used by the Confederate Secret Service for a plot to kidnap and kill Abraham Lincoln.
Do you hear what she's saying?
This is really insane stuff. But I wondered, Bannon knows that,
yeah.
But does Trump know that? Trump, when he's sitting with Nick Fuentes and Kanye West, says, "I have no idea. Yeah. One's an anti-Semite and one's a fascist racist. I have no idea of what's going on." And often he really does seem to be out of it. He doesn't really know what's going on. He knows those people vote too, and little things are like treats, but it's not like Bannon, who's intellectual and means to do it. Is he a chaos agent or is he intentional?
Well, I think that Trump's entire focus is about Trump. I mean, and that's not a unique or, you know, it's not a new observation. So I think that Bannon is such an important figure, and he comes through, and I sat with Bannon actually for hours in the process of writing this. As I told you, I talked to everybody around him, Trump. Everybody that I could, and most of them I was able to. Bannon, I think, is one of the most important because he provides an intellectual framework for what Trump is all about, which is just whatever is best for Trump. And it's a dark, dark vision. On the come retribution point, I mean, he kept on using that phrase, and I thought he was giving a label title for the speech that clearly, and by the way, this was the rebirth of the Trump campaign. You know, the Trump campaign was announced exactly 1 year ago today in Mar-a-Lago. I was there. It was pathetic. Nobody came. I mean, not a single confirmed cabinet member most of his family skipped it. Ivanka wasn't there. Tiffany just got married, so I guess she had a good excuse. Don Jr., you know, he had just been there for Tiffany's wedding, which was at Mar-a-Lago that weekend. It was a Tuesday, was the announcement. And, this was kind of a sad affair. I've got video of this, which, because I knew people wouldn't believe me. People started to leave his speech early. This is people at Mar-a-Lago for his presidential announcement. And they start leaving, and it starts to get, you know, a few people and a few. It's kind of like when you're at a bad baseball game, you know. You know, the Phillies are losing.
We know
even
about
the
this.
Seventh inning, you know, and you're like, you want to beat traffic. And then they started blocking people from leaving. They said it was security, you know, security concerns. I've never heard of security where you can't leave where the guy they're trying to protect is, you know. But anyway, so if you go back to polling from December of last year, you'll find that Ron DeSantis, in a hypothetical Republican primary, because DeSantis hadn't announced yet, is ahead. Wall Street Journal polled December 14th of last year. It's DeSantis in the 50s. About 20 points ahead of Trump in the 30s. His campaign had a rebirth with the come retribution speech because when he announced, it was all this kind of warmed over stuff. He read, it was teleprompter prompt Trump, you know, talking about policies that he didn't care about or believe in. But when he was starting to talk about going after and rooting out the enemies, he didn't use the word vermin, but he might as well have, going out and getting our enemies, the rhinos, the people, you know, the FBI. I mean, he goes after chapter and verse. We're going to get these people out. I'm going to go after the people that are coming after me because their real target is you and I'm standing in the way. So I'm going to, and it gives a new energy to his campaign. But Bannon keeps using the words come retribution. And then I realized that it is this Confederate code word that was used for a plot to assassinate, first kidnap, then assassinate Abraham Lincoln, of the Confederate Secret Service. So I find out there's a book called Come Retribution that came out in the 80s by some Civil War historians all about this. So I ask Bannon, he's like, "Oh, it's a great book. You got to read that." And then when the story came out, where I, you know, because I, when we first put out the first chapter that had this come retribution, and there was all this Confederacy and all this, Bannon like shot me a message like, I hope you pointed out the predicate. I was like, what do you mean, Steve? What are you talking about? Well, it was because Lincoln had called for a plot against Jefferson Davis and the entire Confederate. I'm like, dude, I mean, we're like, okay. Confederate imagery in, you know, 2024 campaign was really something else. But I don't think Trump has any idea what come retribution is. But when eventually when I come out with a story that says it, he knows it. He knows what it all is now. And he knows that there's, you know, he knows it all. And what has he done over the past 2 weeks
since poisoning I first put out the blood and vermin?
Yeah.
Does he understand when he says that? Does he?
I mean, he's gone further in. So when he David Duke endorsed his campaign in 2016, Chris Christie and Reince Priebus. Well, first it was Reince, who was, you know, RNC chair at the time. You know, you got to denounce this guy, man. You got to denounce this endorsement. You got to, This is terrible. And, you know, and Trump's blown off. So Reince goes to Chris Christie and says, come on, you've got more influence with him. You got to tell him. He's got to, this is terrible. This is killing us. So that's when you have the famous line. Christie goes and tells Trump, you have to denounce David Duke. He blows him off later. And then he said, okay, I'll do it. But remember, those people vote too. So I don't think Donald Trump is a neo-Nazi like David Duke, but I think that he wants all of those votes, and he has no desire in denouncing it. But in 2016, he did denounce eventually David Duke and renounce the endorsement. Kanye West comes for dinner at Mar-a-Lago and brings Nick Fuentes, a white supremacist. What a combination. You have the anti-Semite and then white supremacist walk into Mar-a-Lago. It sounds like the beginning of some terrible joke. And endless coverage about how in the world did either one of these people come in and dine with the guy that just days ago announced he was running for president. And there's no denouncing whatsoever. That's because there's no Chris Christie or Reince Priebus around to say, dude, you got to get away from this. He said nothing critical of either one of them. In fact, today, Trump put out a long statement attacking me of all the stuff I wrote in the book, all this darkness about Confederate codes and Waco and the Oklahoma City bombing. What's the one thing that he decided to attack me on today? It was an anecdote about Kim Kardashian in my book.
But and he noticed that he thinks he's Team Kanye. He kind of put that in there.
Yeah. He's like, I would have done it for Kanye, but not for her. She's the most overrated. She voted for Joe Biden. I mean, Kanye may have praised Adolf Hitler, but Kim Kardashian voted for Joe Biden. At least I think she did. I mean. Anyway, so I by the way, can I interject just
for it?
Because so you'll see a little thing in the book. I wrote a book that came out in 1995. So this is the year after I met Trump, and I asked him for a little blurb for my book. Not for the actual book. It was just for my book party invitation. My college buddy, Scott Alexander, is here. He was at the party. My brother's here. Mom. You know, it was like a family and friends kind of a thing. It was a paperback book. But it was about the militia movement and the Oklahoma City bombing. And I was putting together a book party. I had the invitation. I figured, hey, well, Trump, I called him up. Would you give me a quote? I'll send you the book over if you like it. So he gave me a quote. He actually asked me to write it, but he approved it. So here it is. So it's a great quote. I just put it in. What a book. Carl is one of the best in the business, tough, fair, and brutally honest. That's good. It's Donald Trump. So he put out a statement today, as I said, in addition to praising Kanye West. He says this about me. He says, Jonathan Carl just wrote another bad book. He works so hard and has so little talent. Some people have it and some people don't. I mean, you know.
Well, at least he wrote it himself versus asking
that
the
one he definitely wrote himself. Yeah. That was like, yeah.
You know, a couple of your colleague George Stephanopoulos was in the news interviewing Steve Scalise, who asked five times, could not say Joe Biden is the duly elected president. It is a thing. Tom Emmer couldn't be Speaker of the House because he said it's not true. Joe Biden is the president. So we have a speaker who has been an election denier. It's a thing.
Yep.
And you wonder how
a
he got here.
A lead election denier. I mean, Johnson was tip of the spear.
In the story, in the book, you tell a story about Kevin McCarthy, who starts out saying, "This, we're done with him. I refuse." He goes to Mar-a-Lago. Many people see that as the beginning of the road back for Trump, when that picture is taken of Kevin McCarthy in Mar-a-Lago. And you told a story that I hadn't heard before, that McCarthy claimed he was down there for some other reason, went to say hi, and got jumped by photographers.
Yeah.
We know he's not the most honest person. Do you believe him?
You know, I actually think McCarthy is sort of telling the truth. I think there's a little shading to this, but I believe that Kevin McCarthy, by the way, this happened 8 days after Trump left the White House. And you have to go back to that time. He was persona non grata. He didn't go to Biden's inauguration. As I reported, you know, he said he wasn't going to go, but as I reported, Mitch McConnell was already working with the congressional leadership to disinvite him from going to the inauguration. But he became the first outgoing president to skip a presidential inauguration of a successor since Andrew Johnson in 1868. By the way, another guy that was impeached. McCarthy goes, he does have fundraisers in Florida, but he does reach out to say he wants to go and see Trump, which was a major gesture. And it angered a lot of fellow House Republicans who were like, okay, we finally got that guy out of town. But he decides to go. And if you look at the photo that we've now all seen 1,000 times, it's such an iconic photo of this Trump comeback. It's in the book. It's all over the place. And, you know, in that main lobby of Mar-a-Lago of McCarthy and Trump. I mean, look at the facial expression on McCarthy. What he told people in the immediate aftermath is, I got there, and like the first thing he does is he calls over a photographer, and I'm like, what? And then you can tell like the photo's like quickly taken, and news of the meeting leaked out before McCarthy left Mar-a-Lago. So the Trump and the couple of people that were still with him were eager to put that out immediately to say, you see, he still has juice.
Would it have made a difference if more time had gone by with nobody coming to see him, nobody standing next to him?
So I think this is a really good question. And I think that there are two pivotal moments that maybe could have made a difference. That is one of them. If you didn't have the Republican leader in the House go down, and keep in mind, McCarthy made that trip as we were waiting for the Senate impeachment trial to start. And it was a Senate impeachment trial where there were stories about McConnell. There was reporting by my friend Jonathan Martin in the New York Times, entirely accurate, that McConnell himself was struggling with whether or not he would vote to convict Trump. And there were, I remember doing the math and trying to figure out, could there be 67 votes? Could there be 17 Republican senators who would vote to convict? And, you know, there ended up being 7, which is the massive high watermark for a president. You know, I mean, we haven't had a lot of impeachment trials. Actually, we've had a lot lately.
We're getting to the point.
But I think that could have made a difference if McCarthy had said, instead, you know what, we're just going to kind of ignore him and let him go off his way. He was persona non grata on Fox, so he was gone from Twitter. I mean, he was a silent guy in Mar-a-Lago who had started DJing his own parties, literally. There's some stuff in there about this, literally. I mean, it really got weird. I have a chapter called Dark Days at Mar-a-Lago. So, yes, I think that made a difference. But there's another very pivotal moment, and that is 8 days earlier when Trump leaves in the morning of the 20th before Biden's inauguration. He's still president. He kind of leaves the White House. They have a little makeshift gathering for him at Andrews Air Force Base. Again, none of the White House staff except for, you know, Mark Meadows, Stephen Miller, I think, was there. Sean Spicer somehow found his way, even though he hadn't worked in the White House for a few years. But, I mean, there wasn't, like, nobody really came. They literally brought people in from outside of Andrews. Like there were Trump supporters there to say goodbye. Hey, you want to come in? Come to the event? And he goes up the stairs to go on Air Force One to be taken home, his last trip as president. Ronna McDaniel, the chair of the Republican Party, calls him up just to say, she wasn't there either, by the way. Now, she had sprained her ankle, I think it was, so that's why she wasn't there. But she calls to say, hey, farewell. You know, we accomplished a lot of good things. It's kind of a gracious goodbye. And he starts berating her, puts her on speakerphone. Don Jr. is with up in the president's office on Air Force One. And he says, I'm leaving the party. I'm done with you. If you people had fought harder for me, I'd still be president. And she flips out. And I described the conversation in some detail, first reported in Betrayal. She flips out and says, you can't do that. You're going to hurt the people who you're going to hurt the people who did all this for you. And we're never going to win, and you're never going to win, and this will be the terrible thing. And his answer to her is, you deserve to lose because you didn't fight hard enough for me. Okay, over the next 5 days, she and the leadership at the RNC first beg him not to leave and then make a series of essentially threats to him. If you leave, first of all, remember, we're paying your legal bill still. You're getting those back. And most of the money you make is with this mailing list, you know, the great data bank of Trump and Republican voters and supporters. Well, guess what? We're going to make that worthless by giving it to the world for free. So it was going to cost him millions of dollars if he left. What if Ronna McDaniel had said,
bye.
Go ahead, start a new party. He's not Trump now. You know, now he's got he's Trump then. And the calculation that they made was that if Trump left, he would bring his supporters and Republicans would not win in future elections. And look what's happened. They didn't do it, and Trump and Republicans have not won. They've underperformed in all those elections. McCarthy made the calculation, if I'm going to become Speaker of the House, I'm going to need Trump's support. He became Speaker of the House.
For a minute.
I mean, I'm not sure it worked out.
No. And he's never had so many headaches. A key thing for Trump, over and over and over and over, every relationship comes down to agreeing with him that the election was stolen. We know from your previous book, the idea that he understood, he knew he had lost. And so it was like trying to find him a graceful exit. Mark Meadows, we have to figure out how to land the plane. Then he goes into this thing and won't back down. And you ask yourself, does he know it's a lie and he doesn't care? Or has he genuinely convinced himself that he won or the election was stolen?
It's such a good question, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. Jack Smith makes the case essentially that he knows it was a lie, and therefore he actively sought to overturn an election that he knew he lost. Liz Cheney felt this very strongly and made the case in the January 6th hearings. I'm not so sure. I think that he knew he lost in the immediate aftermath. And there's reasons to believe that. And I've talked to people. I mean, I talked to one. I wish I could tell you who, but I just can't. But I talked to one, you know, senior Republican in Congress who told me, you know, about a week or so after the election, when things were starting to get really weird with Rudy Giuliani and the whole thing, who told me, you know, give him time. He's a man who knows he lost. It's tough on him. So I think that there was, and I remember, you know, Kellyanne Conway at the time was telling me that she said, you know, he's not going to give a concession speech, but he is going to give a speech that's going to, you know, look a little bit like a, not conceding he lost, but like acknowledging that there's a changing of the guard. But I think that as things got on, he became, he was the one actively pursuing some of the most outlandish conspiracy theories. He was the one, I mean, one of my favorites, it's a strange way to describe it, but I don't know what else to say. I did a lot of this in Betrayal, and there's some new information on it here. One of these theories was that the Italians had these military spy satellites, right? And they were used to switch votes on these voting machines. And that there were these two guys who knew it all and were ready to blow the whistle at this Italian defense contractor. And they were in jail in Rome, and so in prison in Rome, so they kept silent. And like Trump was obsessed with this thing, so I asked him about it in an interview that I did with him. It's the very last time I spoke to him, in the summer of 2021, and I was like, you don't, because here's what I found out. I found out that Mark Meadows had asked the Department of Justice, the acting attorney general, to investigate this. Can you look into this? And then I found out, and that came out of some congressional investigations pre January 6th, committing emails from the Department of Justice. That's how that came out. But then I found out that he, on a Saturday, I think it was January 2nd of 2021, Meadows, convened a meeting of the acting defense secretary and the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Barrier, and asked, can we send somebody over, our defense attaché, to this prison in Rome to talk to these two guys? So I asked him, I said, Mark Meadows was doing this. I mean, do you know why he was doing this? And he's like, you'd have to ask Mark. I've got the tape. It's amazing. I mean, you'd have to ask Mark. I don't know. Mark's a good guy, good chief. You know, really, really good, one of the best. I don't know why he was doing it. You'd have to ask Mark. You have to ask Mark. And I was like, you don't really think Italian spy satellites switched votes, do you? He's like, well, you know, you'd have to ask the people that are saying that. You'd have to ask I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm telling you, there was a heck of a lot of fraud. So he started to get sucked into whatever he could grasp onto.
And then as you read the book, the question is, does he actually want the job? You note that he announces, and then for 63 days straight, his main campaign activity is going to play golf. That doesn't sound like somebody who really deep down wants it.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, he did more than play golf. He did dine with Kanye West and Nick Fuentes. He did sell these non-fungible tokens, NFTs. You remember those? That was during this time period. He did put out a Truth Social post calling for the suspension of the U.S. Constitution. So he was thinking policy. But I think it's important to kind of see the arc of this re-election campaign, this historic effort by a defeated former president to come back and get re-elected. Because, yes, those 60-some days, he did not leave a Trump property except to go to another Trump property to play golf. But on those Trump properties, he was able to do some of this other activity. But then again, he gets this birth of this campaign as the indictments are coming down, and suddenly this is a campaign about retribution and revenge. Does he want the job? I don't think so. But I think he wants retribution and revenge, and he wants to vindicate himself because he thinks that above all, that his secret sauce in business and in politics, and the reason why he has been successful, and he will say he's much more successful than he actually was, but he's been successful, is because he comes across like a guy that doesn't lose. I'm the winner. I mean, it was an image he maintained and still continued to license his name as he was going through 6 bankruptcies, 4 of them casinos. So I think that is why that's why he cannot accept anybody that acknowledges Biden's victory, because it's an acknowledgement that he lost. And he believes, I believe, that those people that support him so fervently will not support him if they see that he had lost. Now, I think you and I have both covered a lot of politicians that lost some really close and hard-fought campaigns. In my opinion, some of the greatest speeches that I have ever seen have been by people who lost. And I'll give you 2 quick examples. It was McCain in 2008. Loses to Obama, and when he mentions Obama's name, the crowd starts booing and hissing, and he's like, no, no, he's going to be our president now, and our success is based on his success. We need to hope that he is successful and give him everything he needs. That's McCain, much more eloquent than I just did. That was John McCain in 2008. The other one, the 2000 campaign, I spent a lot of time with Al Gore. I spent a fair amount of time with George W. Bush. I was with the Gore campaign throughout that recount. And when the Supreme Court shut down the Florida recount, there were people there in the Democratic Party that were ready to, you know, grab pitchforks. And Al Gore gave the greatest speech, I think, of his entire political career when he conceded and wished George W. Bush all the luck and called in his supporters to rally around what was going to be the new president.
For me, it was covering Bill Bradley. And it's always the experience of, if that guy had just shown up, it might be different.
Yeah.
Two quick questions before we go to the crowd. Because, of course, I think what a lot of people are wondering, they read these polls. They see RFK jumping in, Jill Stein jumping in. The question, of course, is Mitt Romney, could he be talked into it? John Huntsman. So this thing could go any way. And one of the ways it could go is Trump is back. Mm-hmm. And Bill Barr said this about the prospect of what would happen when it comes to policy and governing. He does not have the discipline. He does not have the ability for strategic thinking and linear thinking or setting priorities or how to get things done in the system. It's a horror show, you know, when he's left to his own devices. And so you may want his policies, but Trump will not deliver Trump policies. He will deliver chaos. And if anything, lead to a backlash that will set his policies much further back than they would otherwise be. What does it actually look like day to day if he's president again?
You know, first of all, just an observation. That's Bill Barr, who was, you know, defended Trump throughout the Mueller investigation, basically tried to undermine the Mueller report when it came out, as conservative as it gets, Republican to the core, and listen to what he's saying. And this gets to the point of my anonymous guy, who is not Bill Barr. As I said, this is not somebody who's criticized him. But it's that you, the most searing criticism and the loudest warning about what Trump 2 would look like come from people like Bill Barr, who have seen him up the closest. One thing I would take issue with Barr's quote there is the idea of Trump policies. It's not really clear what Trump policies are. I mean, there are some broad brushstrokes that he's talked about, you know, build the wall, tariffs on our trading partners, beat up on our allies, you know, bring troops home, unless he wants to go and have nuclear war against North Korea before. I mean, it goes all over the place. And I don't think that there is a clear sense of what those actual policies look like beyond what he's actually talking about, which is retribution and revenge.
One of the stories that's interesting
and installing loyalists, but loyalists for what?
Well, I wonder about that as my last question to you, because one of the stories that's come out now that these tapes have been released out of Georgia of Sidney Powell and Jenna Ellis and others talking, and Sidney Powell is upset because she tells the story of Donald Trump saying, give her credentials, and Pat Cipollone's like, hell no, I'm not doing that, right in front of him. And it made me wonder, at some point, does the establishment, finally, there's a massive thump back. I was listening to George Conway on the way over here, and he's talking about the establishment of the rule of law society. You have this entire generation and apparatus of conservative, thoughtful, Michael Luttig, others. Is there, if he wins, almost like a sonic boom that comes from, because it won't, the Democrats can't do it. It would have to be the Republicans.
I mean, you have Republicans like the ones you just mentioned who are trying to sound that sonic boom right now. And by the way, again, these are not like, you know, we like to call them rhinos. These are not like weak-kneed moderates who are like, you know, blow with the wind. These are like some real conservative. I mean, Michael Luttig was on the short list, you know, to be on the Supreme Court. Kind of the dream justice for people on the far right. Really solid guy, very conservative guy. And you know, he's certainly been sounding the line. I'll give another one. Charles Koch, the last remaining of the Koch brothers, at least the Koch brothers involved in politics. Is funding an effort? I mean, it's him and others that he gets to donate to it, to try to expand the electorate in Republican primaries in the early states. So it's not a voter registration drive, but what he's noticed is it's obvious that in these primaries, it's only the hardcore of the party that turns out to vote. And surprise, surprise, that's what you get. And in this case, it's the Trump people. They're definitely going to vote in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, and Nevada. So they're trying to do a big effort to reach out to other Republicans who would normally not be paying attention this time of year and say, get out there and vote, with the idea that if you expand it, you know, somebody other than Trump can win. I mean, but I don't know. I mean, I think it gets to be late. If you're saying if after he wins, I don't know what kind of a sonic boom you can do from the from outside on the Pennsylvania Avenue in Lafayette Square.
But you've said you don't think, no matter how it turns out, you don't think he makes it back to 1600.
Well, look, I have also said that it is absolutely possible that he gets back. There's a lot between now and there, and he's got. I mean, the one reason why I think you're starting to see Joe Biden really engage on Trump now again is they realize that this election, no matter how unpopular Biden may or may not be by next November, if Trump is the nominee, they think that they can win by running against Trump. The people will, you know, the negatives. I mean, it's whether or not he's got one, two, or three, or four convictions. That he is eminently beatable in a general election, but it's scary if you are a Democrat, or if you are just somebody who fears what a second Trump term would look like, to be thinking that you're going in and you're like, I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, there weren't a lot of people that thought he was going to win in 2016, so he could win. But what I'm saying separately is we're still actually a fair bit of time away from Iowa and New Hampshire. That primary is not over. I think that one of the reasons why I didn't write this book to sway an election, but I wrote this book is if you are going in to vote in this election, know what you are voting about. Understand what it is. This isn't like this kind of some sleepy, we're going to go back to 2019 pre-COVID when inflation was low and, you know, there wasn't war in the Middle East and Russia hadn't invaded Ukraine. You know, that you need to understand what it's going to be. And I think that far too few people have really understood not only just what Trump was, but what he could potentially be in a second term.
I think you need to be prepared every now and then for people to stick their head out the window and just scream. And you won't know why, but you will know why as we go through this next year. And Jane Mayer, I love this line as she ended the New Yorker podcast this week. No matter what happens, expect surprises. And maybe some of them could be good.
Yeah, expect surprises. Absolutely.
I know a lot of you want to get some questions. We've got somebody right there and somebody right there and somebody right there. So let's try to get to them.
Okay, thank you. Quick statement and question. I never get to see someone of your stature and authority. And when you walked out on stage, you look so young in person. You really do. And question. One of the criteria to be president is you have to be at least 35 years old, and there's other criteria.
Yep.
Do you have an opinion on the other side that's sometimes being talked about? When is it too old to run for president?
Yeah. Nikki Haley's out there with this proposal. You have a mental acuity test, basically, for anybody over 75, which neatly encompasses both Trump and Biden. By the way, do you know how old Mitt Romney is?
72?
76. I mean, the guy looks like he's like, you know, he looks like 25 years younger than Biden. I don't think that you would ever be able to do that. First of all, as a practical matter, have like an age limit. But I also think that it's not age. Anthony Fauci. I remember him seeing throughout COVID. Guy, you know, he's 79 into 80, 81. He was 82 now. How old is he? I mean, he's out there. He's still, you know, he speed walks or runs all the time, and I don't think it's the number. I really don't.
What I'm interested in is your comments on why it is, or what your explanation is for the fervent support that he has. Now, you say if he lost, if he acknowledged that he'd lost, he'd lose a lot of that support. You also suggest that perhaps a lot of people haven't acquired the information that you set forth in your books. But I, in my experience, I've encountered people who are who should know better, and yet there is this fervent support for him. Why is that?
It's complicated. I think there are multiple levels to it. I think that part of it is that he annoys all the right people. You know, and it's if you are really frustrated with if you think that the system has screwed you, and you see, you know, in your perception, the elites are doing great. Our wages are stagnant. You know, we're boxed out of opportunity, and these people talk down to us. And here comes this guy who kind of doesn't care what people think, and he's insulting all the people that you'd like to get up there and maybe insult. And so I think there's kind of a raw appeal to that. He's also and this is what I think initially got him going is. There was definitely an entertainment factor. I mean, in that primary, going back to 2016, going back to 2015, before he really solidified it, you know, Jeb Bush was like was going to be the big front runner. I mean, Jeb Bush was so carefully stage managed. Every speech was the same. You know, I mean, not exactly, but I mean, basically, you knew what you were going to get with the Jeb Bush thing. He didn't do many. Interviews, except with, you know, he's very careful about who he would do interviews with. And here's Trump, he's doing like 20 interviews a day, and you come out and God knows what he's going to say. And it was just kind of like a break, and it was a break from, so, but now fast forward to today, part of it is still he's angering all the right people to a certain segment of the population. But I also think that In some of these polls that you see, which don't really mean this much this far out, they really don't, but they can scare you if you're fearing what it would look like if he came back, is just the same, like, it's a variation of the are you better off 4 years, you know, than you were 4 years ago, and people look back, and, you know, pre-COVID, economy was strong, world was at peace, I mean... Look, there were a lot of problems pre-COVID, but what's true is most of the drama in the world was coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and we didn't have, thank God, you know, pre-COVID, we didn't have a major crisis. So I think there's a lot of it. You know, Peggy Newton put it this way; I thought it was kind of smart. It's like people want 2019 back. They might not want Donald Trump back, but they want 2019 back.
That is a good.
Yeah.
Well, because many people would say if he'd handled the pandemic differently, he'd be president. And actually, the election denying, a lot of election deniers lost, while people who acknowledge the election won. I wonder if he had been willing to say, "I lost, but don't you miss me?"
Oh my God, he'd probably be like sailing away. Yeah. Yeah.
That and a cup of coffee. there was one other person right there.
Just to extend the previous question, one thing about Donald Trump is that he's not subtle. He tells you what he thinks, he tells you what he's going to do, and then in his own way, he goes about doing it. Given the truth of that statement and the fact that he is right out there, what does that say about the American people that they're willing to give this man a second chance? I used to think that the American people were different than the Germans in the 1930s. I no longer feel that way, and I was wondering what your perspective is on that.
Such a dark question, but it's one a lot of people are asking. Look, I don't think that there is much of an ideology around Donald Trump. I think that Steve Bannon, you know, has tried to put one on him. And I think that he wears it, and if the crowd responds, he feels good about it. And in this retribution notion, you know, people like. And I think that people are, I think what this whole episode has shown is that people are willing to destroy what we thought were norms and customs of American democracy. maybe because they think they haven't worked for them. I don't necessarily think it's because there's a mass movement of fascists in the wings waiting to take over, but there's great contempt for the things that, you know, that have been sacred in American democracy. And that's frightening because the conclusion that I came to in really going through and trying to construct what happened after the election and the lead up to January 6th, the conclusion that I came to is that we found that our system of laws as constructed right here in this, not far from here, is a pretty good system, but it depends on people in positions of responsibility to act responsibly. It depends on there being good people in government. Now, we have a system designed to protect against bad people, so we have checks and balances. But if the leadership is willing to just say, screw it, what do you do? So I think that we could have had a much bigger crisis on January 6th and during that entire transition if it weren't for the fact that there were good people right around Donald Trump, maybe people that a lot of folks didn't think were good people. Certainly a lot of Democrats thought were just as bad as Trump and all this, who stood up and did the right thing. You know, Pence is the most obvious and glaring example. But Pat Cipollone, who was the White House counsel, and his fellow lawyers in the White House, in the counsel's office. There was a guy named Chris Liddell who was in charge of the transition, and I described it as kind of running a clandestine operation in the second floor of the West Wing to create a transition to a Biden administration and keeping it, making sure the boss didn't get too much wind of what was going on. They worked to ensure that things would continue to move in the way they were supposed to move, even if the guy on top had no desire for any of it. And that's why it's troubling to think about what it's like if there's a second one and those people are rooted out, the ones that are insufficiently loyal. But I have more faith in despite what we're facing, I am optimistic, and I'm optimistic in part because of all of those who stood up and did the right thing when faced with this crisis. And, you know, we've got to have some faith in that.
last question.
Thank you. I want to start with building on what that nice lady said. I want to tell you how annoyed I am at you for hearing my wife tell me how much she loves you constantly. So thanks for that. Okay, yeah. But my question actually goes directly on your last words.
Yep.
Thank God there were leaders and responsible people, but what about, you know, Paul Ryan who resigned? What about, you know, McConnell who really has not done a lot? What about, who's the Speaker of the House these days? I don't know. Pick a Speaker of the House. I mean, Tamela talked about this sonic boom.
Yeah.
Where are the Republicans? I mean, other than Liz Cheney,
by the way,
where are they?
She's not around anymore.
She resigned.
Well, no, right. She didn't resign. She lost.
Well, she lost.
She fought and lost.
And what she did.
And it is different. I mean, sure. You know, she went and she was the most popular political figure in Wyoming. And she stood up to Donald Trump the way that she did. And he put her at the top of the list of the people to take out. And then she lost by 30-some points in a Republican primary. I think there is something to that. I think that McConnell, Liz Cheney has some very complicated views of of McConnell. I mean, McConnell stood his ground on January 6th, among other times, but specifically this idea that the Republicans were going to vote to reject certified electoral votes that were sent in by the states and had done all the things properly and were signed by the governors and ratified by the secretaries of state and all. And we're going to vote as members of Congress to reject those votes? On what authority? We're going to tell the people of Michigan their votes don't count because we think there's fraud, even though you guys don't think there was? You know, McConnell stood his ground, and he said, he got up before the Republican senators, and he said, this is the most important vote you'll take because this is about it all. So McConnell, yes, there were many. He blocked the formation of a commission, independent commission, into January 6th. He, you know, he delayed the impeachment trial. He ended up voting not to convict and saying that, you know, he didn't think you could convict, have a trial for an ex-president, even though, you know, he had kind of helped to make that trial not happen while he was still president. But McConnell, on a couple of very important moments, stood his ground. By the way, he's not going to be around much longer either.
As we walk off the stage, yep. This was the last thing I wrote for you. It's election night and Trump wins. What goes through your mind and what do you do the next day?
Can I think about that one and get back to you? I don't know if I have a good answer for you yet on that one. I'm going to have to.
All right.
You know, it's a hypothetical.
And you've covered enough politicians. The first thing you do is you say, I'm not answering a hypothetical.
Right. Yeah.
All right, Jonathan Karl, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.